So welcome back everyone to the second of this four-part mini-series on Science, Torah, and Rationalism. And today the topic, I believe, is with regard to the cosmology. Just checking that. Yeah, scheduled topic is cosmology. What we're going to do is we're going to be exploring a certain topic which I think, of all the entire field of conflicts between Torah and science, with regard to the rabbinic area, conflicts between Chazal, right? Chazal is an acronym for Chachameinu Zecheinu Levracha, our sages, may their memories be for a blessing. The conflicts between the Talmud and science, we're going to deal with what I think is the most fundamental mini-topic for this entire topic. Now, as you may know, my book stirred up some controversy about 7-8 years ago, and this was really the main issue. Conflicts between the sages and science. And the biggest mistake I made is that at the time, lots of individual passages from the Gemara that were being discussed. And what I didn't realize at the time was that the passage we're going to be discussing today is the most fundamental passage to this entire topic. It's really the key to everything, to understanding how different perspectives with regard to Chazal and science developed. Now, it's really the key, absolutely the key to everything. So it all comes down to a couple of lines of Gemara that seem pretty much incomprehensible when you first look at them, but we're going to explain them, and they're actually more straightforward than you might think. So let me just get this up on the whiteboard. Okay, let's see how this works. Okay, can people see the whiteboard? Can you see it on your screens? No? How do I share the whiteboard? Should be shared. Can you see it? Okay. Chaim, Aaron, you see it? Okay, so here we have, we're going to be looking at two little discussions in the Gemara. Okay, so let's take a look at it. The rabbi taught, the sages of Israel say that the sphere is fixed and the constellations revolve within it. And the scholars of the nations say that the sphere revolves around the earth and the constellations are fixed within it. Right, so that looks completely incomprehensible. And most people who learn the Gemara, they come across this, their eyes kind of glaze over and they kind of skip past it. Because people don't really have any idea what it's talking about. But it's actually quite simple to explain what's going on here. What we have here is two competing cosmologies, right? Two competing views with regard to the structure of the universe. We have the ancient Babylonian cosmology, which is being presented by the sages of Israel. And we have the Greek Ptolemaic cosmology being presented by the scholars of the nations. Now, in the ancient Babylonian cosmology, the universe consists of the world, which is basically a flat disk, and the rest of the universe is a dome, here called a sphere, that's fixed over this disk, and the constellations, the stars, are whizzing around on the surface of this dome, of this sphere. That's actually a hemisphere, a half a sphere. Okay, so that is the ancient Babylonian cosmology being presented by the sages of Israel. The scholars of the nations, they are presenting the Greek view, and the Greek view is that the world is round as a sphere, and it's surrounded by lots of other spheres. Now, one primary one, and this primary sphere moves around our planet. And the stars, the constellations, are fixed in the surface of this sphere. Okay? So, you have the Jewish view is that the sphere is fixed, there's a thick dome over the world, and the stars move around in this dome. And then there's the view of the Greek view, which is that no, there's a sphere revolving around the world, and the stars are fixed inside. Okay. So, the Gemara continues to say that Levi, that's Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, he raises an objection to the Greek view. We have the technical objection to it. It doesn't need to concern us now. I'll just paste it on anyway in case you're interested. Text. Okay, that being said, the response to their view is that we've never found the Great Bear constellation in the south, the Scorpion constellation in the north. He says that if the sphere was revolving around the world, it should revolve all over the place. And yet we see that certain stars are only found in certain places. So the Abhyakov says, no, that's not necessarily an objection. Maybe it's not just wobbling around all over the place. Maybe there's some kind of pivot. Right? So it revolves in a specific way, and therefore certain stars only appear in specific places. Okay, now, this is just really an introduction to the next dispute of the Talmud, because Talmud gives another dispute, which is the one that really concerns us, just that this one was an important introduction. So the Talmud continues as follows, with another dispute between the sages of Israel and the scholars of the nations. The sages of Israel say, during the day, the sun travels below the firmament, and at night, above the firmament. And again, they're presenting another aspect here of the ancient Babylonian cosmology, which is the world is a disk, the universe is a dome over this disk, that's the firmament, and during the day, the sun travels beneath it, it rises in the east, sets in the west, and at night, when the sun sets, it then changes direction, like it's going down towards the evening, and it changes direction, tunnels through the firmament, and then comes back up behind it, so that the next day it can again rise in the east. That's the Jewish view. And the scholars of the nations say, okay, the daytime we agree with you, the sun travels beneath the firmament, but at night, instead of circling back up behind it, it goes on the other side of the world. Now at this point, Rebbe says something different. Rebbe Hanasi, who in the previous dispute he was arguing against the Greek view, so here at this point he agrees with the Greek view. He says their words seem more correct than ours, for during the day the wellsprings are cool, and at night they steam. He's saying at night you see vapor rising up from wells. And he said, presumably that's because the sun is passing underneath them and heating the subterranean source of water. Okay, so that's, of course, not correct, according to our present-day knowledge. But nevertheless, he was saying that the Greek view appears to be correct. Okay, so that's what we have in the Gemara. And what we're going to do is to look at how the Gemara was viewed. This Gemara is viewed throughout the nation. Certainly, it's a face value. What you have here is a dispute between two competing cosmologies, two competing views of the universe. And what's interesting is that Rav Yehuda HaNasi, now he concedes that the non-Jewish view appears to be correct. And we certainly know now that the non-Jewish view is correct. Well, it's not completely correct, there's no sphere revolving around us, but it's correct in the sense that at night, the sun is on the other side of the world. Right? The Jewish view here is that at night, the sun is circles up behind the sky on the far side of the firmament. The non-Jewish view is that no, at night, the sun is on the other side of the world, and we know that the non-Jewish view is correct, and that's what the Yehuda HaNasi concedes. Clear so far? Any questions? Before I go any further, is everyone clear on the Gemara? It's very hard to give a share when you don't see any feedback. Okay. Wait, is that a question coming up here? Okay. Alright. And by the way, this view which is presented here, the ancient Babylonian cosmology that the sages of Israel present, you'll find it in other places in the Gemara. Different aspects of it appear in other places. Okay. Now. Gaonim mention this, or the first authorities to mention this, and the Gaonim say, they just point out that they follow the straightforward meaning of the Gemara, right? That Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi conceded that the Greeks were correct, the Greek view was correct, and they point out that this really is true, right? That the Greeks clearly are correct, that the sun goes on the other side of the planet at night, it does not go behind the sky. Now, that, then we have Rambam, and Rambam not only takes the Gemara at face value, but he also presents this Gemara as presenting a very important principle. Right, this Gemara presents the principle, the idea that the sages of the Talmud, when they spoke about matters not directly to do with Torah, that is describing things in the natural world, so it wasn't based on a tradition received from Sinai, it wasn't based on divine inspiration, it was just based on what they figured out. And that's why, and they knew that, and that's why they were quite willing to concede when they were wrong. Right, so in the Guide to the Perplexed, right, Rambam cites this Gemara to point out that the sages of the Talmud were not infallible in matters of natural sciences. They just said whatever they figured out, and when they were wrong, they are willing to concede that they were wrong. Okay? Interestingly, Rambam has a slightly different version of the Gemara. Rambam describes the Gemara as saying that the sages of the Greek sages, they were victorious over the Jewish sages. Right, a bit of a stronger language than we have here. What we, and our Gemara just says, already says that there would seem more correct, the Nirin de Brehem. Rambam paraphrases or quotes, he may have had a different text, a version in which it says that Nitzchu Chachmi Umas Ha'olam, that the non-Jewish scholars were victorious over the Jewish sages. So that's Rambam. Then you have Rambam's son, Rabbeinu Avraham, who goes even further in presenting this Gemara as a paradigm for how to view the sages' knowledge of science. Right, in his introduction to the Agadic materials printed at the beginning of Ein Yaakov. So Rabbeinu Avraham, points to this Gemara as a classic example of the sages of the Talmud not knowing everything about science and being aware that they didn't know everything about science. And he goes further to say, look, you have the other hand actually conceding that the Jewish sages were wrong and the non-Jewish sages were right. And Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam says that this shows the tremendous intellectual honesty of Rebbe. But normally, you always try to support the home team, but he acknowledged that the home team was wrong. And Rabbeinu Avraham says that's why Rebbe was called Rabbeinu HaKadosh. He deserves the title of being called our Holy Rebbe, because there's nothing holier than being so dedicated to truth that you even concede when the home team is wrong. As we've seen, even more significantly, Rebbe is the one who, in the first argument, was arguing against the non-Jewish sages. So for him, he'd invested his argument against the non-Jews, and then he's willing to concede, but I think actually now in reflection their view is actually correct. Right, that demonstrates tremendous intellectual honesty. Okay, so we see that Rambam and his son Rabbeinu Avraham, they're accepting the straightforward meaning of the Gemara. Not only does it bother them that Rebbe is wrong, but on the contrary, they're very happy because it proves a principle that the sages of Israel received knowledge from Sinai was Torah and not science, and it demonstrates their tremendous intellectual honesty that they were willing to admit when they were wrong. Okay. Now, it's not only Rambam, the famous, the paradigmatic rationalist who interprets the Gemara this way. This was basically the normative view in the medieval period, right? Amongst the Rishonim, amongst the Torah scholars of the medieval period, they all took the Gemara at face value. And, why shouldn't they? I mean, the Gemara is very straightforward, right? It's very clear what the Gemara is saying. You have an argument between the Jewish sages and the non-Jewish sages, and Rabbi Hanasi says the non-Jewish sages appear to be correct, right? I mean, you might say, well, of course they take the Gemara at face value. What other way is there to take the Gemara? But as we'll see, there were others who twisted themselves into pretzels to avoid taking the Gemara at face value. Okay, so we have, to mention some names, Shmuel ibn Tibbon, Rabbi Yitzhak ben Yedaya, Rabbi Lezer of Metz, Tosfos Rid, Rabbeinu Yeruchim, the Rosh, Rabbeinu Manoach, the Ritva. Right, they all refer to this Gemara. And, most of them are quoting the Tosafist, Rabbi Lezer of Metz, because he quotes this Gemara in a particular context. He's discussing the idea about when you're kneading matzah, when you're kneading the dough, you have to use mayim shelanu, water that has been drawn and is sat overnight outside of the ground. And why do you have to use water that's been drawn? And you can't use water that's been sitting in the ground overnight. He says because if this water has been sitting in the ground, it's been heated. It's been heated by the sun passing beneath the world. And he points out that this is in accordance with the view, the Greek view, that the sun passes beneath the world at night, which is against the view of the Chachmei Yisrael, that the sun goes behind the sky at night. So this is what the Tosafist Rabbi Eliezer Metz says, and many other Rishonim quote him on this, right? And they're all, it's just even in passing for them, they're all, you know, perfectly at ease with the fact that, you know, that this halacha about what water you're using for matzah is fundamentally based on the idea that it's the non-Jewish sages that were correct. And they're fine with that, because, you know, that's what the Gemara says, and Rabbi Hanasi himself concedes it. Okay. Now, when did things change? Oh, so 1 second, I should mention there's one different view. So in the times of the Rishonim, in the medieval period, you do find one authority that takes a different view. And that is Rabbeinu Tam. Okay, Rabbeinu Tam, who's, you know, one of the leading Tosfists, he is Rashi's grandson. He's also an avid falconer, but that's a topic for another occasion. Got an article appearing on that in Jewish Action soon. Rabbeinu Tam says as follows. Rabbeinu Tam, and he's quoted in the Shittim of Gubet, says, and he says that all the Rebbe said was that their words appear to be more correct, meaning that they appear to have better arguments. But in fact, the view of the Jewish sages is correct. The Jewish sages weren't conceding, Rebbe wasn't conceding that they were wrong. They weren't wrong, they were right. That's what Rabbeinu Tam says. And there are a few others who quoted. And you know, nowadays, if you ever mention to people, you know, that, well, you've got the Gemara here, if you're having an argument with somebody about whether the sages can be mistaken about science, and you're arguing with somebody who insists that they can't be mistaken, and you mention this Gemara, so very often the person will say, well, you see Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says that they weren't wrong at all. So the Rebbe wasn't conceding that the Jewish sages were wrong. All he was saying is that the non-Jews have better arguments. That's all he was saying. Okay. So first of all, I've noted this is, you know, very much a minority view, just a view of Rabbeinu Tam. But let's think about what Rabbeinu Tam is saying. He's saying that the sages of Israel are actually correct. Now, were they? Does the sun actually go behind the sky at night? The answer is no, of course it doesn't. So, quoting Rabbeinu Tam in support of the idea that the sages are infallible, it certainly isn't helpful nowadays. Because nowadays, I don't think anybody would say that the sun really does go behind the sky at night. So that's the first point to bear in mind. The second point to bear in mind is that, wait a second, so according to Rabbeinu Tam, that's the Owen's question, what's the time difference? No, don't know. According to Rabbeinu Tam, you know, why did Rabbeinu Tam say this? Why did Rabbeinu Tam say that the sages of Israel were actually correct? So there's two possibilities. It could be that he did it for the same reasons that people today say that the sages of Israel were correct, which is, you know, a kind of conservatism, you know, you want to boost the stature of Chazal, you want to make them infallible, you want to say that they had Ruach HaKodesh, or that this knowledge was received from Sinai. That could be what he was portraying Chazal. But that doesn't appear to be the case. Because if that was the case, that there were these, you know, infallible geniuses with wisdom straight from God, then how come they couldn't even argue their case? If they were right, and about something very straightforward, that where the sun goes at night, you'd think they'd be able to prove it. Right? You'd think they'd be able to argue against the non-Jewish nations and say that, well, you know, the reason why the well springs are steaming at night is not because they're being heated up, it's just, I don't know, why do they steam? It's not steam, it's just vapor, no? It's just that the, wait, I can't think, what is the reason now? Probably that the air cools down quicker than the water at night. No, something to do with the heat capacity of water, something like that. Anyway, whatever the explanation is, if that was where it was within the town was coming from, surely the sages of Israel would have known it. So that doesn't appear to be where Rabbeinu Tam is coming from. Why does Rabbeinu Tam say that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wasn't actually conceding? I think the reason why he said it is because he thought that it so happens to be that the sages of Israel were correct. There was Rabbeinu Tam, who lived in France, in an area that's still where Greek science really hadn't penetrated. So he thought that the factual reality is that the sun goes behind the sky at night. So So since he thought that that was a factual reality, then how good would the other Hanasi have been conceding? So I think that's where Rabbi Yochanan is coming from, that he thought it was actually true that the sun goes behind the sky at night. But not that it must be true because the sages said so. No, that it happens to be true, and therefore the sages surely would not have been conceding. Okay, so that's where I understand Rabbi Yochanan. And I'd also say this because Rabbi Yochanan's view is actually quoted and apparently endorsed by Ramban. Now, Ramban certainly was not averse to the possibility of the sages of the Talmud being wrong. Right? He mentions things that statements along those lines in a few places. So why here is he saying that the sages of the Talmud were correct? It's not that they must have been correct, it's that he thought they were correct. Whereas he thought the sun does go behind the sky at night. Truth is, it's hard to figure out Ramban's view. There appear to be some contradictory statements in his comments on Genesis. So I'm still not exactly sure what Ramban's view was. Anyway, so far, so that brings us to the end of the medieval period of the time of the Rishonim. Right, so far we have the mainstream view of the Gaonim, of the majority of the Rishonim, which is to take the Gemara according to what it says. You've got a dispute as to where the sun goes between the two models of the universe, the Babylonian cosmology versus the Greek cosmology. Rabbi Hanasi concedes that the Jews are wrong. The Babylonian cosmology is not correct. Right? So, and that's the way that the majority of Gaonim and Rishonim take it. You have this minority view of Rabbeinu Tam, quoted by one or two others, that know that the sages of Israel were actually correct, and the sun really does go behind the sky at night. Okay. Now we enter the 16th century, and this is where everything got very stressful. Okay, one second. Joe Berry is asking, at what point historically did the world realize that the Earth is a rotating sphere? And you think it depends where. You know, say the Greeks got to it first, and it took a while to spread elsewhere. You know, it took a while for the Babylonian cosmology to die out. Certainly by, certainly by the 16th century, the entire civilized world knew that the world was a sphere. Okay, now, the 16th century is where you start to see a large number of authorities refusing to take the Gemara at face value. And they avoided the straightforward meaning of the Gemara in a variety of different ways. Let's start with Rav Moshe Ippolit, the Roma, right, 16th century Poland. He says that the sages of Israel are correct, and that they must have been correct because of their great stature. And so what did he do with this Gemara? So, he has a very strange reinterpretation of the Gemara. Hold on a second. Just trying to find it in my notes. I'm going to pull up my notes in a second. There we go. Okay. According to Rav Moshe Ippolit, when the sages of Israel said that at night the sun goes above the Rakia, above the firmament, it doesn't mean that it goes above the sky. It means that it goes over the land on the other side of the world. And he said the land can also be called Rakia. We say in the Rakia Ha'aret Samayim, that God spreads out the land. So really it's the land which is the Rakia, and that's what the sages are saying. But when the sages said that during the day the sun travels beneath the Rakia, it means beneath the firmament. And when it says that at night it goes over the Rakia, it means over the land on the other side of the world. Right, so, and obviously this is extremely forced, right? This is a very, very contrived way of learning the Gemara. You don't find in the Rishonim at all, because it's extraordinarily contrived. Right? How do you say that Rakia, you know, flips meaning within the same paragraph? And you know, we have problems because, like I said, the view of the sages of Israel is not just found in this Gemara and Pesachim, it's also found in Bava Basra elsewhere, and he has to like reinterpret all these other Gemaras, and it's incredibly forced, incredibly contrived. That's what Omar does. And you know, and again, he insists that the sages of Israel, they were so smart, they must have been correct, and he goes on and on about the importance of the statue of the sages. Okay. So that's one approach, right, to reinterpret the Gemara as describing a completely different astronomical phenomenon. That's the approach that Ramah takes. It's very, very difficult, but he's obviously very passionate about doing it. So what we're going to have to do is to figure out exactly, later, well, at last, well, why was it that all his predecessors were fine with taking the Gemara at face value, and then Ramah feels this need to reinterpret the Gemara in an incredibly forced way. Okay. And by the way, I'm not the first person to observe that it's incredibly contrived. Zaria Hirasi has described it an extremely, well, he calls it as he sees it. Okay, so that's the Ramah, and there are others who also take a similar kind of reinterpretations. Again, very forced reinterpretations. Then you have, actually, first I should have mentioned that there's a Yitzhakar Rama and a Barbanel. Now, where does Ramah say it? He says it in Tarasa Ola. Oh, all the sources that I'm saying, you can find them in a monograph called The Sun's Path at Night, which you can download at rationalistjudaism.com. Okay, so if you're missing any of the sources, don't worry. You can just download the monograph afterwards and see all those sources. Okay, so Yitzhakar Rama, you know, Kedis Yitzhak and Abarbanel, they accept the Gemara at face value, like all the Rishonim did, but you see that they're very uncomfortable with it. They apologize for the Chacham Yisrael being wrong. They say that, well, what do you expect? They're the ones, they're busying themselves with Torah, they're not studying science, they didn't have time to master science, it wasn't their area of interest. So, you know, the bottom line is they accept the straightforward meaning of the Gemara, just like the Rishonim did. But you see they're very uncomfortable with it and they have to apologize for it. Okay? Two approaches we see. We've got Barbanel, Yitzhak Rama, who are accepting the face value but are uncomfortable. Again, this is all 16th century, or slightly before. You have Ramah, who insists that the sages of Israel must be correct and has to reinterpret the whole Gemara. Then you have David Gans, who Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who were Talmidim of the Maharal. And what they do when they discuss this Gemara is they use this Gemara to show the tremendous wisdom of Chazal, and they do that by completely ignoring the second part of the Gemara with regard to where the sun goes at night and focusing only on the first part of the Gemara with regard to whether the stars are fixed in the sphere or not. Remember the first discussion, you all had this other aspect of the dispute between Babylonian and Greek cosmology. In the Babylonian view, the sphere is fixed and the stars move around, whereas according to the Greek view, the stars are fixed in spheres, in these crystalline spheres which move around the world. So in the 16th century, that Greek view had been disproven. In the 16th century, Kepler and Tycho Brahe had proven that the stars are not fixed in spheres, the stars actually have independent motion. So, with Yom Tov Lipman Heller and David Gans, they use this to show, look, you see, the sages of Israel have been vindicated by modern science. And David Gans even quotes Tycho Brahe, the great astronomer, as saying that the sages of the Talmud, you know, they were actually correct. Right, so they use this Gemara to demonstrate the tremendous wisdom of the sages. What's the problem? The problem is that when the sages said that the stars are moving around independently, they were not presenting the 16th century view of astronomy of Tycho Brahe. They were presenting it as part of the Babylonian cosmology, where there's a dome over the world. Now, to say that they were correct in this aspect, that the stars are presenting independent motion, I don't know how much it really helps, because it's not as though they have the correct view of cosmology. Now what about that whole second part of the Gemara, where an aspect of their cosmology is that they believe the sun goes behind the sky at night? So if David Gans or Yom Tov Lipman Heller, you know, they don't mention that. You see that they are, you know, what did they think about it? It seems like they tried not to think about it. So here you see an odd approach of referring to this page of Gemara, this passage, and yet ignoring the second part and claiming that the first part vindicates the sages. Then we have the approach of Maharal. Maharal takes the approach that the complete that all this Gemara is not even talking about astronomy. He says it's obviously not talking about astronomy, because how could they have believed that the sun goes behind the sky at night? They couldn't possibly have believed that, therefore it's not talking about astronomy. What is it speaking about? A very deep metaphysical idea. He explains what it is. It's pretty much incomprehensible for me. Actually, if you look at the Maharal, Be'er HaGola, so there's an edition published by Machon Yerushalayim with lengthy footnotes explaining each part, and there's no footnotes in this part. So I guess the editor, Rabbi Hartman, didn't really understand what Maharal was saying either. There's an art scroll, Maharal Be'er HaGola, which also omits these parts, so I suspect that the translator, didn't understand what Maharal was saying either. Anyway, Maharal insists that the Gemara is not actually speaking about astronomy at all. And therefore the sages were not actually incorrect, they weren't scientifically mistaken. Instead, the sages were speaking about a certain metaphysical idea. And this is Maharal's approach with everything in the Gemara. Now again, of course, it's very, very forced. It's an incredibly contrived reading of the Gemara. And it goes against all the Rishonim. All the Rishonim, without exception, even within the Talmud, they all agree that the sages of the Talmud were talking about where the sun goes at night. They all agree that that's what the Gemara is discussing. Maharal says, no, it's impossible. There's no way the Gemara is speaking about that. Well, all his predecessors thought so. Well, obviously, again, the Maharal's position is extremely difficult. And again, like I mentioned, today, if you have an argument with somebody about could the sages of the Talmud have been mistaken about science, and you quote this Gemara, so the first thing they'll say is, well, they need Tam. Then you'll say, what, believe the sun really does go behind the sky at night? And then they'll say, well, Maharal says that the Gemara wasn't even talking about that. What basis? And he's going against all the Rishonim. All the Gaonim, all the Rishonim are very clear that the Gemara is to be taken at face value as speaking about astronomy. Because you can see, that's what the Gemara is speaking about. So the Maharal's approach, therefore, is very, very difficult. And finally, you have another approach. Rabbi Maharal was not the only one to take this approach. Ramchal also. There were others who followed this idea. And finally, you have Yosef Ashkenazi, who was a staunch anti-rationalist of the 16th century. And he insisted that the sages of the Talmud were correct. That the sky really is a dome and the sun really does go behind the sky at night. That's what he insists. Okay, so what do we see? We see that beginning in the 16th century, and I should mention, there were still those who accepted the Gemara at face value. There were still those, plenty of authorities who followed in the path of the Rishonim. But for the first time in the 16th century, you see a lot of Torah scholars who are clearly deeply, deeply uncomfortable with the Gemara, and they try to get out of it. Either they present apologetics for the Gemara, like Yitzhak Rahman and Barbanel saying that what do you expect, Chazal, they weren't really studying science so hard, that's why they got it wrong. Or they claim that Chazal, reading the Gemara along, like the Ramah. Or they say that they focus on a different part of the Gemara where the sages appear to be vindicated. Or they claim that the Gemara is speaking about metaphysics, even though there's no precedent or any real reason to believe this. What was going on? So, I'm not certain, can't be sure about why in the 16th century everything changed, but I've got a theory. Theory is as follows. Before the 16th century, so the Jewish world, you had Ashkenaz and you had Sfarad. You had Ashkenaz, where the Jews were kind of really very cut off from the Gentiles. And you had Sfarad, you had Spain, where the Jews were very much exposed to them, but they felt very much part of the joint grand search for knowledge. Like they were shown in the Torah scholars of Spain, they felt a certain kinship with the Muslims. We're all philosophers together. Part of the grand search for knowledge. There wasn't this deep rivalry. In the 16th century there, we have a kind of different situation where Jews were exposed to non-Jews, but not in any kind of friendly sense like in Spain. And even more so, you had non-Jews beginning to make these tremendous strides in knowledge. And you had the University of Krakow, which was the leading center of astronomy in the world. And in Prague, where the Maharal was, you had Tycho Brahe, the world's leading astronomer. So you had these non-Jews who were making tremendous strides in scientific knowledge, the Copernican Revolution and so on. I'll speak about that next week. And meanwhile, you have the sages of the Talmud, who not only are they not up to date on the Greek astronomy, they're still even another step behind on the Babylonian astronomy. So what I think was, in the 15th century, it was just very embarrassing. It was very embarrassing that the sages of the Talmud should be so far behind in their views on astronomy when the Gentiles have these very prestigious universities and observatories and they're making tremendous strides. That is what I think is going on here. A bit of evidence for that, perhaps, you can see in David Gans. Right? He's the Talmud of the Maharal. He's the one who wanted to focus on the first part of the Gemara, claiming that it vindicated the sages. His introduction to his book, he says that the reason why he's writing about astronomy is because he's embarrassed at how little Jews seem to know about it, and it doesn't look good in front of the non-Jews. So really, I think that's what's going on in the 16th century. Now, what's interesting is how it plays out afterwards, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, that it's true you always will have those who accept the Gemara at face value. There's Shmuel Raphael Hirsch, when he's in his famous letter about the scientific knowledge of the sages, so he points to this Gemara as simple proof that the sages' wisdom, their received wisdom from Sinai, was in the realm of Torah, and when it came to science, they just knew whatever people figured out back then. And more recently, you have Herzog, the first chief rabbi of Israel, tremendous Torah scholar, he also points to this Gemara as an example. My own mentor of Aryeh Carmel also points to this Gemara. But those who accept the Gemara at face value are continually declining in number. And views like that of the Maharal are continually increasing. Again, I would say that the main opposition to my books was due to my saying that the sages of the Talmud were sometimes mistaken when they spoke about scientific matters. And, at the time I pointed to other Gemaras, I realized at the time that this is really the Gemara that shows it. But my opponents were saying, no, God forbid that the sages of the Talmud were saying that the sun goes behind the sky at night. Yeah. Like the Maharal, the sages were speaking about metaphysical matters. And it's true, that is the Maharal says. But Maharal was a revolutionary. Maharal had no precedent, nor any particular arguments to support its case. What did Maharal say? It couldn't possibly have been that they believe the sun goes behind the sky at night, because that would be ridiculous. It wouldn't be ridiculous. This is a problem. This is very anachronistic. A lot of people have a very hard time with the idea of the sages of the Talmud believing that the sun goes behind the sky at night, because they think that it's stupid. It's stupid to believe that, and the sages of the Talmud weren't stupid, and therefore they couldn't possibly have believed it. But it's not true. It's not stupid to believe it at all. It's perfectly reasonable. Right? We happen to know otherwise. Why? Because we have the benefit of a lot of people who've been very smart people over the centuries who've been looking at the sky and thinking about it. But it's not unreasonable to believe otherwise. It depends on what you're working with from the outset. We know there are lots of very, very smart people who used to believe things that are wrong, right? Aristotle. Very smart guy, and he believed lots of things that are wrong. So it doesn't mean that they were stupid. But this is a situation we find ourselves today, that the Maharal's approach is taken as a given. If you look in the Altskol Gemara, so in the Shoftim Talmud, so before reaching these pages in Pesachim, we speak about these astronomical matters, so there's a footnote saying that of course the sages were not speaking literally, and really they were speaking about deep metaphysical matters, as the Maharal says. Well, yeah, that is what the Maharal says, but Maharal, with all due respect, he was a tremendous innovator here. Right? He had no precedent amongst the Rishonim, and there's every reason to believe that that's not what the Gemara actually meant. I can understand why our school has to say that. They need to cover themselves. They don't want to be slip-skinned alive, as the saying goes. Slip-skinned alive, sorry. But, this Gemara is very straightforward. So, We have a fascinating situation here. We have this astronomical revolution of the Babylonian cosmology being replaced by the Greek cosmology. And the sages of the Talmud themselves are fine with it. Now, if you're an Asi, says, yeah, okay, we're on. The non-Jews are right. He's fine with it. And the Rishonim are fine with him being fine with it. Some of them are even better than fine. Right? Rambam, Rabin Avraham and Rambam says, look how intellectually honest they were. Right? And the other Rishonim just don't give it a second glance. They're like, yeah, okay, he was wrong. He admits he was wrong. But beginning in the 16th century, people can't accept it. They can't accept that Chazal were wrong about this, even though Chazal themselves are perfectly happy to say they were wrong about it. And over time, that view increases to the extent, you know, Maharal just didn't make any reference to any Rishonim. Didn't say what he thought about them. But nowadays, in certain Orthodox quarters, the idea is that, no, nobody ever said otherwise. The sages of the Talmud were infallible in scientific matters, and there's no mainstream view saying otherwise. So this Gemara, you can see why I feel now it's the key to the whole Torah science issue. Annie researched it in depth 2 or 3 years ago, and it's a shame that I didn't make it, you know, front and center at the time of the great Torah science wars of 2004-2005, because here you see it very clearly. You have a Gemara which, according to all the Rishonim, is to be taken as a dispute about astronomy. According to most of the Rishonim and plenty of Acharonim, the sages of the Talmud were wrong and agreed that they were wrong and were fine with it. And then you have this other view developing that they no, the sages of the Talmud were correct, and just gathering steam until you get to a point where people can't even imagine that anyone ever said otherwise. So that's why I feel this is such a crucial topic. And again, if you want to see the bracket in detail, you can download the monograph at rationalistjudaism.com. Any questions? Okay, so someone is asking, do I think that deep down, modern Torah scholars who claim that Chazal are infallible, do they really believe that? I'm sure most of them do. Yeah, but again, I doubt any of them have ever really studied this part of the Gemara in great detail. Some of them for sure do. Moshe Shapiro, you know, is an absolute perfect reincarnation of Maharal, and he's convinced, like Maharal was, that the sages of the Talmud, they were never speaking about science. They were always speaking about metaphysics. Okay, so I think we'll leave it there. Still take questions on the chat box if you want to, but I'll stop the recording. No, I can't. I'm not in tech support. Okay, so someone's suggesting that maybe people in deep down know that Chazal are wrong, but they don't feel they can say it. I'm sure that, like I said, I'm sure there are many people in both categories. There are people who cannot imagine that Chazal could possibly have been wrong, because they view Chazal as being almost supernatural beings. And there are others who deep down they know it, but they feel that, you know, it's not, we don't want to say it. I can understand it, right? Again, I think I mentioned this last week. I can understand why they don't want to say it, because they feel it would destabilize and undermine people's reverence for the Gemara. And they might be right. For some people, maybe it would. So I can definitely understand it as a social policy. I can understand why people wouldn't want to say that the Chazal were wrong. Again, essentially, because a lot of people can't handle the idea that Chazal could have been wrong about this, but they weren't stupid. A lot of people just can't wrap their heads around it. They have no historical sensitivity, and they don't understand that back in history, people could have been very wrong about things, and yet still very smart. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. I'll see you next week when we'll be talking about the Copernican revolution. Have a great week.